We just had our meal, and I know it's not a nice thing when we are full like we are, and then sit and listen to a very long presentation. I understand that Serena has spoken to the presenter that they need to be as short as possible. We are going to take the water resource management, after which we'll take waste and pollution, and then climate change. So please, let us stick to... No, we are not going to stick to this time. This time is 30 minutes. Now we'll be fast asleep at that time. Yeah, let us take half of that, please. Let's take half of that. All right, let us then start with the water resource management by Amen Kara. What's up?
Thanks, Chair. My name is Iman Karar, and my presentation is really the brief that we've got is that to provide a very broad overview of water resource management. We understand that there is a lot of knowledge around the table in terms of water services, the kind of issues that arise from water services, water supply, sanitation, and so on. But water resources is slightly a different issue where we're talking about fresh water. And what I'm going, and as we have the chair, I'm going to really rush. Luckily, there's a lot that has been said before, so I will not repeat that. I will just try to focus. I will skip largely the introduction, be very brief on that. What is water resource management? What are the legal provisions that are there in place for that? How do we manage water resources? What are the instruments that we use? And who is responsible for managing water resources, and this is the institutional arrangements from the different levels in government and so on. Now, the water cycle, you've heard it, we've got the very low the resources. When we talk water resources, we're talking surface water as well as groundwater, and this is the main point that I want to highlight here. And also, how do we define a catchment? And most of the South African legislation you would hear is catchment management agencies, is catchment management strategies. A catchment is basically the watershed, the point at which where the water falls down and it all collects into the same kind of channel, creating a river. So any of the land that's surrounding that river or that tributary, where the water comes into the same river, this is, if you delineate the whole area, this is called the catchment. In some other places you find it's called river, it's called watershed. Other places it's a basin that we're looking at. Most of the literature in South Africa is the catchment that we talk about. And the catchment doesn't respect any administrative boundaries. It could run from the one administration, one province to the other, but also it doesn't respect any international boundaries either. So from the one country to the other, it can also flow. We heard from Refka that the water rainfall is very variable around the country. You find the yellow place is a very dry place, then the green is less drier, and then you find the blue. And here, this is just looking at the annual average. And so the water resources are limited. There are major rivers. Some of them, you can see the coastal rivers are smaller ones, but there are serious, the large rivers that we have. This is just to show all of those around the country. And this is mainly where our water resources come from. As far as groundwater is concerned, you see that there is a similar fashion. The pink parts are also quite low in potential for groundwater, and it's not as uniform in zones, but you find there are pockets of some structures that can keep quite a lot of groundwater. The other map that you see on the left-hand corner is refers to the use of groundwater, and we have quite a bit of use for groundwater, except that there is more potential for more use. There are certain issues around groundwater being quite useful when it comes to rural water supply and also for local agriculture. So having said that, where does the water come from? There is this magic process of balancing the supply versus the demand. Supply, the demand is always increasing, but the supply is limited. Now, if the supply is limited, we really have to be very careful as to how do we allocate, how do we use this finite water, and also how do we make sure that the quality does not deteriorate to make it unfit for use. So the basic triple bottom line, as you would see it written in some places, is to ensure that we have economic efficiency, which is the optimum social benefit that comes from the specific use. So if we say agriculture has got a 4% contribution to GDP and it uses 62% of the water resources, maybe that makes you think a little bit. But it has got very far-reaching social benefits, because agriculture is probably the only way to get out of the trap of poverty. So you have to really start thinking about how do you work these things together. Social equity, we have a legacy in the water sector of very uneven distribution of water. And the third one is, how do we ensure what Stanley was talking about? How do we ensure that we have environmental sustainability? We have an ecosystem that will continue to give us good fresh water for now and the future. So to be able to maintain and match that between the demand and the supply, the South Africa has been extremely good in large infrastructure and transfers from the one basin to the other. This is taken from the Natural Water Resource Strategy of 2004, and we can see that for Gauteng, most of the water that's used for that very strong economic hub is coming from outside the province. The same thing for the Mgeni River, where there is a large, this is the lifeblood for the KwaZulu-Natal province. The water is coming from Tugela, is brought to the Mgeni River to support that economic activity. Now, if we see this is something that costs a lot of money. We heard before about the Lesotho Highlands project, where water is coming from Lesotho to support all the activities in the Gauteng area. And if we look at the water in most places, it's not found where you need it, and some infrastructure interventions are needed. This is the one way of managing it, the supply and the demand. Another is that how do you manage what you have where you have it in the best way possible? And the National Water Act has come out, which is the main instrument, the legal instrument that has come. But where does it come from? And it comes from the Constitution itself, where we have the Bill of Rights that everyone has the right to have access to sufficient food and water, and everyone has the right to an environment that is not harmful to their health or well-being, and to have the environment protected for the benefit of the present and future generations, which is the sustainability aspect. And to be able to do that, government departments have to cooperate together. And we heard it before, water is not one portfolio of one department, it's something that goes right across. And the cooperative government, to be able to be operationalized, we have the Intergovernmental Relations Act. And here we can see the different instruments that help in that. Now, the Natural Water Act is the main policy governing water resource management. The Water Services Act is governing the water services side of things. And the central guiding principles in the National Water Act are those of equity, efficiency, sustainability, and representativity. And the law, from the law's principles, it all stands out that some for all forever, and I think that slogan is very expressive of how do we want to see the water managed in the country. That access should be access to the limited resources on an equitable basis in a sustainable manner for generations to come. Also, the National Water Act has the base, the purpose of which is that the nation's water resources are protected, used, developed, preserved, managed, and controlled in ways that take into account that we're meeting the basic human needs, promoting equitable access, and I think you heard about the minister's priority areas, water department, water allocation reform, one of them, redressing the results of past racial and gender discrimination, efficient and sustainable beneficial use of water, and the economic social development, and also providing for the growing demand for water use, and meeting international obligations, as well as the climate change impact. Now, the Natural Water Act also, what is it based on? We spoke about the catchment. It realizes that water is found in discrete units, which are hydrological units. Water is a national asset, and the national government is the custodian of that water, and it can exercise its powers as a public trustee. Water to meet basic human needs and to maintain environmental sustainability are guaranteed as a right, whereas the rest are entitlements to use water for a finite period of time. So water for domestic use, for water supply, this is something that is guaranteed from the in the reserve. Water resource management is decentralized to regional and local institutions. As a democratic government, this is something that the law also speaks about, the decentralization of the management and making decisions at the local level. Now, these are the instruments, some of the instruments, how we do that. And you've got the handouts with you, and you can refer to the WRC for more documents if you would like to go more into that. And this is just some elaboration on the different aspects of how do you manage the resource, the protection of the resource, the water pricing, water resource planning. Now, looking at what is the role of the state, if we're talking about who does what when it comes to managing water resources. And here we have the state as the public trustee, as we said, acting through the minister, must ensure that water is protected, used, developed, conserved, managed, and controlled in a sustainable and equitable manner for the benefit of all persons and in accordance with its constitutional mandate. Minister is ultimately responsible to ensure that water is allocated equitably and used beneficially in the public interest while promoting environmental value. Also, national government, acting through the minister, is the only entity that has got the strategic leverage of regulating, of saying, we are going to allocate water based on these principles, not necessarily on technical principles, but on also social equity issues. If we say water is a social good and an economic good, someone has to make sure that there is a responsibility and some ways of making that happen and facilitating that. Now, when it comes to water management institutions, we have the department as a national government, and in the second tier, we heard before about catchment management agencies. And this is really just leaving it and mapping it out without going into any detail, because each one could take a day to discuss. And the catchment management agency is the second tier, which is responsible for drawing up catchment management strategies for managing water resources at the local level. So the whole country has been divided into 19 water management areas to be responsible for doing that. And we can see that if we have 283 local authorities, we have 19 water management areas, if you can superimpose that on it. You can see how difficult it can be to manage the resource, especially when you're talking about across boundaries. And local government has got a big role to play when it comes to being part of the decisions that need to be made. And I want to share with you, this is the landscape of the number of institutions that are involved in water resource management on the left-hand side, and the right-hand side is the water services. And we can see that the level of the different institutions that we have. I will also not go into detail, maybe not useful. The point that I want to take you with is that to manage water resources, the planning that happens at a number of different geographic levels. They have some at the national level, At the national level, you have a national water resource strategy, as Minister was saying, is due now for review. The first one was done in 2004, which was a huge national exercise. It was really a very big undertaking. So that is in place now. The second tier is the catchment management strategy, which really speaks to the provincial development strategy. Now, if we can get synergies between these two, and that water falls within that larger development strategy, then we know that we can see some tangible results on the ground. The same thing goes for the integrated development plans, which are now the responsibility of each local government, the water services development plans, and that of the catchment management strategy should also be something that talks to one another. And this is going to be the best way of ensuring that we get coherent and integrated planning between the different tiers of government. Then just the last two slides to deal with the international water management institutions. And here just to share that there are four rivers in South Africa, the main rivers that are shared with other countries. And those are the Limpopo, the Nkomati, the Pongola, and the Orange Cinco rivers. And all of them drain 60% of the country's land area and contribute to about 40% of its total surface runoff. And approximately 70% of its GDP and a similar percentage of the population are supported from the rivers, making its management, joint management, something quite important. And there are a number of institutions that have been set up in agreement to make sure that there is that interaction with the different countries that share the rivers with us. I think this is just a very broad overview here, starting from national into the more local, looking at water resources. But mind you that each component could be amplified for quite some time. So this is just to provide an overall view. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was the presentation on water resource management. I believe that we do have all these small documents in front of us, but it's very difficult to follow if you don't have a document in front of you. You need to have documents in front of us. But the look of things, I don't think that I've got every document here. The next presentation will be Waste and Pollution by Ms. Linda Kotra. Thank you. Come again.
Can I make a comment here, Chair? I think it's well and good to have this presentation, but others, we are impaired. We can't even read them. I've been, watching. You can look. The majority of all these slides are so small that you can't read. You can see it there, but when you have to make, reference, you have to come back and read. What are you going to see? Even the map, the gray map that's presented there, one can't even read. What is that map all about? I'm just personal observation. Really, it is very serious. That many slides like this, you just can't read because they are so small. They just, the words just vanish. You don't even know what is written there. Most of all things that were presented this morning, except the one from the department, that's a better one, but the rest, just so unfair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. No, I agree with you. I'm sure it's for the first time that you've seen with glasses on, because I don't wear glasses. But today, because of the nature of the presentation today, I decided to go and look around for my old glasses. I don't wear glasses. I'm struggling. I was really struggling when I was seated there. I thought maybe it's only my documents who were like that. But to be honest, the information is very important, but you can hardly make out what is written there. The piece of paper are beautiful. They're so beautiful. They're in color and all that thing, but unfortunately it's difficult to make out what is written here.
We promise to make them available. Electronically, send them to the secretary.
Oh, that's fine. We'll appreciate it. They'll just distribute to members then. The next presenter then is Waste and Pollution by Ms. Linda Bosky.
Thank you, Chair. Pollution and waste, it's incredibly difficult to try and summarize and capture this in the space of 15 minutes, so I'm really just going to touch on some of the key issues. And you'll notice in the presentation that I have a very strong emphasis and flavor towards domestic waste management, I think for two particular reasons. It's one that I'm passionate about myself, and I think the reason for that is that it's a challenge that faces local government with regards to waste management at that level. But I will do my best to touch on all of the other issues as well very briefly. The topic is really around the brown agenda. We have the green agenda around conservation and protection, and the brown agenda, which really deals with those issues that that touch on waste and pollution, which can have an impact on the environment and on human health. And I suppose the reason for this is that we know that there's a direct correlation between a country's GDP, or their economic development, and the amount of waste and pollution that they generate. As a country's GDP increases, so does the amount of waste and pollution associated with that. And for a country like South Africa, where economic development is important, we have to find new ways of doing things to essentially break this link between development and waste. We know that the manufacturing of goods produces unwanted byproducts, and after we've used those products as consumers as well, we typically end up with something left afterwards which we need to dispose of. And if we don't deal with these wastes properly, essentially what we end up with is pollution, either through emissions to air or discharges to water as wastewater, or disposal to land, and typically that should be through engineered landfill sites, but we know that many of our sites in South Africa are essentially dump sites which have not been properly engineered or constructed. And I'm going to show you a couple of photos that I've taken from around the country with regards to waste management as we go on. But in terms of the different types of waste that we have, the first is around domestic waste, and this is the responsibility of municipalities under the Constitution. What we're looking at is waste that is generated by us as consumers in terms of our households and businesses. And there are two important components to domestic waste management. The one is simply around city cleansing, making sure that our cities are clean. And it was a point that was touched on this morning around the amount of litter that we see in our urban areas these days. The second one is around waste collection and disposal, simply collecting it from our doors and disposing it in a responsible manner. Typically what we're looking at here is general waste, but obviously, I mean, we're all producers of waste and we know the kinds of things that we throw out in our homes. And we will find a certain amount of hazardous waste in those waste streams, things like detergents, chemicals, old batteries that we might have, electronic waste. I'm sure many people have quite a few old computers that are stored in their houses that they just simply don't know what to do with. That's an example of many of our urban rivers that we see, a large amount of litter that essentially clogs our rivers, and if one can call that a river, but essentially a canalized section of a river through an urban area. This really talks to the heart of city cleansing, and the result of this is that there is a direct impact on human health. It introduces disease, it introduces vermin into the area. Many people as well don't know what happens to their waste once they put their bags or their wheelie bins out on a Tuesday morning or a Wednesday morning. You know, the truck comes along and collects it and takes it away. But essentially to make sure that we have properly designed landfill sites that minimize the amount of risk that we have on the environment. The second type of waste that we deal with is our industrial waste, and this is often hazardous in nature, and it requires disposal to proper engineered landfill sites, and I'll show you a photo of that. There are also other alternative methods that we have, things like chemical or biological or physical treatment. We have thermal destruction, such as incineration, and I know that many people are against incineration, but as a technology, I think if done responsibly, it's not so much around the technology, it's the management of that technology. And then the obviously disposal that we have to landfilling as well. So a number of alternatives there. That's just an example of a sanitary engineered landfill site with proper liner designs, proper leachate collection systems. And as I said, many of our sites in South Africa are not like this. They're essentially old quarries that we've now converted into landfill sites or dump sites, and to deal with the consequences of that. Many of you may be familiar with the concept of the waste hierarchy, and this is something that we've seen come through in legislation now recently, starting to look at things like cleaner production. Our industrial process is changing the way that we do things so that we don't produce the same amount of waste, or that we change the nature of the waste that we produce. So to prevent waste, to minimize the amount of waste, that waste that we cannot prevent in the first place, how do we then either recover that or reuse it or recycle it? And then as a final option, treating it to make it less hazardous, and disposal really is the last option that we have. And as I said, we've seen this move from end of pipe solutions now to more minimization, reuse, recycling. We've seen that change in emphasis in the white paper that was put out in the late 90s, and certainly now in the recent Waste Act that's just been promulgated, we see this change in mindset around waste management. And as I said, it's really around trying to reduce the amount of waste that we're generating, to reuse waste, and then recycle waste back into the manufacturing process. And in this, a new concept that we see arising as well is looking at waste as renewable resource. So what opportunities do we have in the waste that we produce to reduce our burden on natural products into the manufacturing process? These are some photos of waste that are being currently recycled in South Africa. A lot of paper waste that is being recycled. These are PET bottles, so plastic waste recycled, obviously things like beverage cans as well, and now also moved towards things like composting, so a lot of organic waste, garden waste, reuse opportunities around that as well. This is a photo from an uncontrolled landfill dump site, essentially, and you can see in the front there, for example, if it's clear to you, just the amount of recyclable waste that is still going to our dump sites in South Africa, a large amount of plastic waste in the front. And it's essentially trying to remove these recyclables from our waste streams as early on in the process through source separation, collection at source, curbside collection, so that our recyclables don't actually get to this point on the dump site. There are a number of advantages of reuse and recycling. First of all, as I've mentioned, it reduces the amount of raw material that we require in manufacturing. Reducing the amount of waste that goes to landfill. Many of our municipalities are faced with shortage of airspace. And certainly in terms of planning of our landfill sites, people don't want landfill sites right outside their back door. But obviously the further one puts it out, you increase the costs in terms of transport and disposal. And it also has the potential to create new businesses and jobs, both in the formal and in the informal sector, by certainly moving the collection of recyclables to the curbside. To move on then to pollution, that is the definition that comes out of the white paper on integrated pollution and waste management. But essentially what it is a change in the environment caused by that waste that we produce that has an adverse effect either on human health and well-being or on ecosystems. And to put it really simply, it's really the mismanagement of the waste that we produce. And the reason why it's so critical is that it does impact human health and it does impact ecosystem health. Water and waste are just two things that don't go together. And also a photo taken from one of the dump sites in South Africa where you can see a direct contact between our water resources and the waste that we have. Essentially, the effect of this is that we produce things like leachate, which will infiltrate into our groundwater. It will pollute our groundwater resources. It can seep into our surface water as well. And we then have to deal with cleaning up of our water resources. Another example is burning of waste. This photo was taken about 2 years ago at one of our uncontrolled dump sites, which accidentally caught on fire when we had large fires going through in Mpumalanga. And the result of it essentially took just over a week to put this fire out because of the amount of paper and organic waste that was sitting in this landfill site. And this obviously has direct impacts in terms of greenhouse gas emissions besides the atmospheric pollutants that the neighboring community is now exposed to. The other waste stream that we have is our discharges, our industrial effluent, and certainly although I've touched largely on solid waste management, our wastewater treatment works similarly also face a lot of challenges in South Africa, and I think that the bringing together of water and environment under a single ministry really provides us with a wonderful opportunity now to start talking about solid and liquid waste in the same sentence. And I think we excited around some of the alternative policy instruments that we see. I know Water Affairs has been working on the waste discharge charge system for a number of years now, and the potential opportunities that that provides to essentially change behavior at source in terms of both the quantity and quality of waste that we discharge. The other one as well is around acid mine drainage. It's something that was touched on earlier in Rivka's presentation, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. The photo on the right is perhaps a little too small to notice here, but essentially in a lot of our areas we sit with mining waste in very close proximity to our residential areas. And that photo, there's probably less, or probably around about 100 metres between that mine dump site and the neighbouring community. And you can see those brown stained areas there. It's essentially the acid mine drainage that is seeping out of the toe of that dump site, which can have an impact on those neighbouring communities. One of the things that we're looking at in terms of our wastewater treatment technologies is not only to just treat this acid mine drainage, but to also look at the recovery of viable byproducts. We know that there's a lot of metals in these acids in the acid mine drainage. We know that there's the potential for sulfur recovery as well. So essentially turning it into a closed system of both treatment and recovery. The challenges facing municipalities, and this is certainly one that I'm very passionate about, is that we know that our municipalities are faced with a number of challenges around waste. The Department of Environmental Affairs ran a process over the past few years to identify these as well. The CSR in parallel has also done a number of research projects to look at this. But we know that we're faced with issues around financial management within municipalities. We've got problems around equipment management. Do we have the right equipment for both the collection and treatment of our waste? We have shortages of staff very often in many of the municipalities. And then also issues around institutional behavior. Very often, people put in budgets in terms of certain equipment that is required, and that gets changed, and very often it has implications on the final equipment that's purchased. We know that we have a skill shortage specifically around waste management. And I think when one combines this with the high turnover of staff that we see at a local government level, it really does present challenges in terms of sustainable waste management. So the question is that recognizing that we have these challenges, how do we implement waste management practices and procedures that can work hand in hand with this? We also sit with situations. This is a photo taken at one of the dump sites in Gauteng. We know that there are very many people who obtain a basic livelihood from collecting recyclables on the waste site. Whether one refers to it as picking or scavenging, the fact is that this is a reality of our sites in South Africa. We have people that live on them, we have people that raise their families on dump sites and who obtain a living from these. The question is, how do we take these recyclables out of the waste stream and bring these people to a level where they can still earn a living, but they can work in an environment which is more conducive than working actually on the tipping face and having to deal with working around equipment like this that can cause injury and death to these people working on the site. This is a photo that was taken actually just around the corner from where I lived last year in Pretoria, and I think another reality of what we sit with is that we've had a number of strikes of staff in the waste management sector as well in the last few years, and the result is that we have a lot of trashing of waste in urban areas, a lot of litter, and again, this introduces potential disease and vermin into urban areas, and certainly a challenge that municipalities have. So what is our response to these issues? I think the key thing is that through sound research, what we hope to do is to essentially provide the kinds of scientific evidence which is needed by government or society or by industry to essentially support and inform the policy and the decision-making that is required around sustainable waste management. Certainly in terms of the technologies that we develop in support of industry to look at, as I said, both treatment and product recovery. Look at waste as a renewable resource. There's a lot of opportunity there as well. And we essentially have no choice. We have to address this issue, both to mitigate the impact of improper waste management and also the fact that we have to adapt to these changing environments that we have. So our focus is in three specific key areas. I think we recognize the fact that technology is not going to solve our problems. Pollution and waste are essentially behavioral issues, and we need to address those behavioral issues as well, which is why we embed that waste treatment and utilization technology within our waste and society research. So we look at the governance and behavioral aspects of waste management and then essentially matching that with the environmental health issues to try and understand the impacts of pollution and waste on human health and to mitigate that. And I think at that point I'm really going to stop up. It's been a flying overview of pollution and waste, but I'd be more than happy to go into detail at future date if required. Thank you.
Do you still have another presentation? Where are you taking over from?
On climate change.
What? On climate change? Yeah, okay, no, it's fine. I've addressed it to reduce our problems. The climate change and water?
I'm going to speak overall on climate change, Madam Chair, and then Chris Mosetti from the Water Research Commission will speak specifically with regard to water.
Why did this happen?
I'm going to speak overall on the projections for South Africa and our policy response. I won't speak for a particular sector. Mr. Mosetti will speak particularly for the water sector. I have cut out a lot of my slides, so I'll speak very quickly.
You can't do the whole thing. It must be divided.
Yes, we have divided it, and I've just cut out quite a lot of my slides. And Mr. Mosetti is going to speak particularly for the water sector.
All right. So yours is this sexy one, system?
No, mine is available on the table over there, that's right.
So the sexy one is Mosetti.
Mr. Mosetti, yes. Much sexier than me.
This one. All right, you bet.
Thank you. I'm going to speak very quickly overall for South and Southern Africa. And Chris is going to talk about climate change, specifically for the water sector. I'd like to, in South Africa, the climate change community, no matter what institution we're at, is quite a big team. I'd like to acknowledge my co-author, Mark Tadros at UCT, and also the input from Colette Wanda at the department, and Brian Manzano and Guy Midgley at Sandy. So I'm going to very quickly touch on climate change. I'm going to look at the projections for Southern Africa, just look at temperature and rainfall, and then I'm going to finish up by talking about some of our thinking around adaptation and response and the road to Copenhagen that the Minister's already touched on, and the Nairobi Declaration. I've cut the presentation down, but people are very welcome to email me, and I can send a longer version also of what the members of the Portfolio Committee have there. Chris is then going to talk about climate change implications for the water sector. Talking about climate change is often quite challenging in the middle of winter because people say, is global warming really happening? And we have record cold temperatures in part of the Western Cape province. Well, the greenhouse effect, which causes climate change, is often a lot of misconception about it. Basically, it acts in the same way as a greenhouse. Incoming solar radiation from the sun comes through our atmosphere. The presence of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere is actually a natural process. Without that, we wouldn't have life on Earth. What we've done as human beings is that we've taken that process and we've augmented it, if you like. And we've put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And what they've done is that they've trapped more temperature and they've raised the temperature of the lower atmosphere, which is the part that we're very interested in when it comes to climate. And that has a range of impacts on our climate. Changes in temperature is merely one of them. So I think what is not always well explained in the media, and it's partly because as scientists, I think we're not always the best communicators, is that in fact climate change is already occurring. So far we have a collective picture of a warming world. The global average surface temperature has increased by about 0.6 degrees centigrade, and in parts of South Africa, for example, in the sun belt to the north of here, and in the low belt, we've seen over the past 50 years an increase in temperature of about a degree. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but we need to look at future changes in the context of that. For the future, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change acknowledges that all of Africa is likely to warm during this century. If we look at the sort of more sophisticated projections for Southern Africa, we see increased temperatures, average temperatures, minimum temperatures, and maximum temperatures more distinct towards the interior of South Africa and pretty much through all of the months of the year. It's a very consistent finding. In terms of hydrological changes, it doesn't feel that way today, but we're sitting in a part of Southern Africa that's projected to have less rainfall during the critical winter rainfall season, It's one of the reasons why the Western Cape province has tended to move before other provinces in drafting a climate change response strategy, but some of the other provinces are moving along. And this just shows some of the significant hydrological changes for southern Africa. The Western Cape has received quite a lot of attention as a result of that. How are we responding? Well, the Minister's touched on this. At the moment, the draft climate change adaptation policy response framework, which is under drafting by this department, looks at sectoral strategies, and each sector will have to draft and is in the process of drafting sectoral strategies. For example, we're working on the biodiversity and climate change policy drafting process at the moment. A sectoral approach, and we've spoken about this already this morning, can be a bit flawed, and so something that we're very interested in climate change, and this goes to other issues as well, is looking at multi-sector strategies. So, for example, how do you have, under climate change, interdepartmental coordination on water, health, livelihoods? And this goes to the second point up here, which is acknowledging that many of the things that we experience in South Africa are what we call complex emergencies. Climate is a very small part of what's going on. So, for example, Namakwa Water is operating in an environment of diminished water, but it's also operating in an environment of rather large institutional challenges. So there's stresses long before we look at climate change. That doesn't make climate change less important. It means that in our strategic and policy response, we have to look about managing complex emergencies and multiple stresses, and in creating an incentive for intradepartmental and interdepartmental coordination. We need to focus on strategies that do more than just addressing a single problem. I don't think we have the luxury in South Africa of looking at policy and strategies that focus on only one thing. So we need to look at synergies between different objectives. We need to look at progressively exceeding critical thresholds, not just waiting until disasters happen. And from the communal farmer to the mining house in South Africa, we have a lot of experience in dealing with climate risk. We don't have the most friendly climate long before we look at climate change. And so we need to root what we're currently doing around climate variability, and we need to think about climate change adaptation in that way. So internationally, where are we at the moment? Well, South Africa and SADC actually had a very interesting point. We have very good climate science. Climate change scientists aren't always the best communicators. And the point where we are at the moment is we're trying to translate that climate change science into real sectoral and multi-sectoral impact right across the government and for different departments. So, for example, the second National Communication on Climate Change, which is led by SANBI, is going to be a highly policy-relevant tool that we hope will be something that decision-makers such as those located here can use to look at the latest findings, to look at the latest sectoral impacts, and make recommendations around intersectoral strategies. The global Change Grand Challenge, which includes the idea of a Global Change Bureau, which translates science outputs into something that's more understandable for policymakers. And then, of course, the adaptation and other climate change units at this department. And in SADC, people are working at coupling climate change capacity building to the existing SADC early warning and disaster management processes. I'm going to finish up by just looking at some of the sobering realities. The Minister spoke about the G8 summit at L'Aquila initially on Friday, and Ban Ki-moon did welcome the agreement to the long-term goal of 80 to 95% by 2050. Of course, there are no, as she said, there are no midterm emissions targets there. And not having a baseline basically is the equivalent to taking the speed limit on the N2 and making it voluntary and just telling people to go slower, rather than giving them a particular speed limit that they have to keep under. It's open to a great deal of interpretation, and it leaves a lot of loopholes. So hopefully, as we move towards the end of the year and we look at sealing a Copenhagen climate deal, we'll look at midterm emissions targets, we'll look at baselines, and we'll look at appropriate mechanisms for finances to developing countries to adapt. Without much further ado, I'm going to hand over to Chris, who's going to talk about climate change implications specifically for the water sector.
Thank you very much. That was climate change in SADC, right?
And then, Chris, which one are we going to do now? Climate change and implication for water, ne?
Climate change and water.
All right.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. After speaking, after Emma has spoken, I think that makes my job very easy. So I'll just be very, very quick. Just before I touch on climate change, I think it's very important for us as a point of departure to recognize that there are other stressors that we already are subjected to. Of course, this has already been mentioned in previous presentations, the issue of overuse, quality impact, demand, and of course, skewed distribution of water in the country. Then we can get on climate change and water. But first of all, I'll just explain very briefly some of the basic concepts that I'm using in the presentation, and then look at the impact of climate change on water, vulnerability assessment, and adaptive capacity. Of course, the issue of international and national initiatives have been referred to, but I'll just touch from the water viewpoint. And then such as some of the roles and responsibilities for the water sector and water-related climate change projects, and conclude by looking at some of the challenges. I think it's a given, everybody now knows, that rainfall in South Africa is half the world's average. There's very little rain. They've already been stated that actually the rainfall in this country reduces from the east to the west, from 1,300 millimeters per annum to 50 millimeters per annum. And of course, what makes matters worse is that this is often the rain that we have is often interpreted by vegetation, which evapotranspirated back into the atmosphere. Rivka earlier alluded to the fact that we only have 8.6% of the total rainfall that is now available to run on surface, to fill the dams, and to eventually replenish the groundwater storage. The other complicating factors are the overexploitation, of course, the water quality impact, the increased demands, and the issue of the infrastructure from the viewpoint of access. And of course, the issue of poverty and health. It has already been indicated that climate change is a cost-cutting issue, and water itself is cost-cutting. And climate change superimposed on these challenges makes the matter situation worse. Just to explain some of the terminologies, you'll pardon me because I think most of you know already what these are about because people have already spoken about them. But climate variability is actually a short-term variation from months to a few years. While when we talk about the climate change, we're thinking of a trend over a long time. If you look at that map below and you focus on the screen, you focus on the period between, for example, the 1900 to the 1950, you realize that if we use temperature as a factor, I mean, as a parameter, the temperature goes up and down over the period. It is climate variability, but there is clearly a trend of increasing temperature with time, and there is climate change. Then, of course, vulnerability is the degree to which a system or a community copes to climate change or does not cope to climate change. In other words, it talks to the level of sensitivity to the change. How sensitive is one? If you look at that little round picture on the left at the bottom of the screen, you'll find that the poor guy on the left-hand side can hardly cope, whereas the brother on the other side with a glass of champagne can cope. This is actually showing you that even if people are subjected to the same, even if we are all subjected to the same stress, the poor people suffer the most. And of course, adaptation is the ability to adjust to the change or to be resilient to the impact. Whereas the greenhouse gases, they have already been explained, are the gases that trap the global warming. Emma talked about the greenhouse effect. And these are carbon dioxide, methane, ozone, and all those, but these three, carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous, are the major ones. And then the mitigation is actually actions to reduce these greenhouse gas emissions that Emma talked about. In simply put, this can be achieved by shifting from fossil fuel burning technology to a climate-friendly option. Now, the climate change impact on water and on other things. If you look at that picture, you find that the climate change and rainfall patterns, frequency, distribution, and intensity. The temperature rise due to the heat trapped by greenhouse gases, but also we could have the rise in sea level. Of course, this climate care, we all have had, I believe, of the ice caps melting and the water filling the ocean. But if temperature goes up, what happens when things are heated? They expand, and of course, that sea level rise, the implication can be very bad because the water can actually, the saline water can intrude into our groundwater resources and impacting on quality, among other things. And of course, impact could be on health, the issue of mortality, infectious diseases, on agriculture, crop yields, on water resources, water supply, on forestry, on coastal areas. People have talked about these things, so I can go over the next slide. But the other issue, which is even of great concern, is the more frequent extreme events due to climate change. The state president observed a couple of days ago that we have had serious disasters as well this summer, especially in the coastal provinces. And indeed, if you look at the number of incidences in disasters, the blue there is actually the sub-Saharan Africa. You can see it has been the incidences have been increasing from 2004, for example, to 2006. In 2004, we had about 48 incidences, increasing to 52, and so on. But if you compare that with other parts of Africa, for example, the Middle East and North Africa, you can see there's not much difference. Why is that the case? This is markedly due to our capacity to be unable to adapt to an extent. Just near our home, remember the floods in Mozambique? That picture there shows the flood in Mozambique over a very short period. It's from August 1999 to March 2000 and to March 2001. The area was already flooded, as indicated over there. So these coastal areas, poor communities located in informal settlements with poor infrastructure are often the most vulnerable. Of course, the minister this morning has shared with us the fact that Africa is most vulnerable because we're very poor. Impact of climate change on water. What is the hydrological response? This country is already a climate risk environment. This is not scary. This is not trying to scare anybody, but it's a reality that we are vulnerable due to our dependency on the natural resources. I live in an urban area. I might not realize this, but think of the other poor people out there in the villages. They really are dependent on the natural resources. Increasing temperature due to climate change could result in increased evaporation rate. Now, what does that do? That reduces the water that is supposed to fill our dams and so on. And also, that can impact on the soil moisture and hence impact on agriculture. And it can also cause the infestation of malaria. We now know that certain areas that were not malaria infested in Africa are now malaria infested. And if you look at the picture on the right there, maybe it's very, very small. It shows the climate change vulnerability in Africa, but let me not be stuck on that. Vulnerability assessment. Now, vulnerability assessment depends on resilience of the impacted community or impacted system. Hence, it is crucial to determine the capacity of a community to cope before you come up with suggestions on how to adapt, to inform adaptation action, in other words. And resilience itself depends on availability of and access to the resources. I can give you an example of poor community on the community in Milden area in KZN from one of our projects. And these, again, the women who were trying to make do through agriculture. Now, they had a lot of constraints. They have constraints around institutional issues, but one of the major constraints to the livelihoods of the small-scale farmers in the Milden area included lack of access to information, to resources, to tools to support their adaptation action. And the researcher asked them a number of questions. One of the questions that was asked was, how did you cope with the losses? Some of them tolerated the loss, and some of them had to diversify, 15% diversified, and started doing other things, shifting to other forms of making a living from farming, so on. National and international, Emma has already talked about that, but this is just to indicate that the sector provides input to the country's position paper that informs the international negotiations, which are actually led by the environmental component of the department. And during negotiations, the water sector and other partners, such as the SAMVI, Department of Agriculture, and DST, focus on water-related aspects and research and systems observation, technology transfer, and so on. Adaptation framework process. I'll just share with you some of the roles and responsibility in the following slides. Adaptation process. In order to adapt, one must be aware of the threat, and secondly, one must intend to adapt, and thirdly, one must actively adapt. Aware, through access to information. Intention, the regulations that we have can influence us. I think the previous presentations have talked to various regulations. And of course, there could be climate change regulation as well, maybe in the future, who knows. Active adaptation through the range of various options. If we take water resource managers as an example, there could be a decision framework on climate vulnerability and climate change. For example, at operational level, which happens in a very short space of time, maybe 0 to 7 days, there can be irrigation scheduling, flood warning, the field operations. And in medium term, we could be talking about the development of the operating rules, which the Department of Water Affairs, of Water and Environment is already doing, of course. Water orders, water allocation, demand management. But this can also be done at other, at provincial and, of course, also at other levels, such as the local level. In the long term, we are tracking the issue of supply and demand. In other words, increasing storage alone is not enough. We'll have to manage our consumption as well. And maybe in a reservoir resizing, like it has happened about months ago, when even in the Western Cape, there was a dam that had been built by the department. Now, what about the adaptation framework? We have the research. What is the role of the research and what is the role of the implementation? We've got the knowledge, data, tools, information that has to be generated from the research, an undertaking of assessment, capacity building and awareness. On the other hand, the departments or the implementers need to mainstream adaptation action into planning and management. In their implementation, of course, there has to be continuous evaluation and monitoring. Support to local communities. It is important for us as a country, of course, to have the National Adaptation Plan of Action, which is necessary to provide the vision on adaptation response strategy. To support communities on adaptation action, we all know, if you look at the picture on the left-hand side, this is the typical picture that you get in the village. And perhaps this community also would like to be able to have access to the resource like you see on the right-hand side. You need to determine the people's needs. It's very important to undertake vulnerability assessment to find out what the needs are. And the needs should be addressed in the context of communities' own traditional approaches. In other words, local knowledge, traditional knowledge is very, very important. And then you can deal with the gaps and provide the information that is required. Just to give you examples of some of the water-related climate change projects that we have just completed about 4 projects now. We have 10 that are ongoing, and of course, we also have 5 that are planned for 2010. An example is the one that is undertaken by the WRC on adaptive interventions in agriculture to reduce vulnerability of different farming systems to climate change in South Africa, in order to address some of the issues that have been referred to, such as, for example, assessing the vulnerability of crops and then suggesting appropriate adaptive techniques. The other one is to develop, of course, development of decision support guidelines for vulnerability assessments and adaptation requirements among the rural communities. Of course, to develop decision support guidelines and then to rapidly identify and prioritize key vulnerabilities and then come up with some adaptation requirements. And in conclusion, Chair, I think some of the challenges that have actually been alluded to are the same challenges that I'm talking to. Given the complexity of existing stressors that I referred to in the beginning, such as overuse of the resource and pollution impacts, it is not easy, but it's not impossible to attribute or quantify climate change-related impacts, and that's what the ongoing research is attempting to do. Uncertainties in predictions based on global models. Of course, we are doing the downscaling. We are coming up with other approaches to be able to deal with that issue. And the issue of availability of adequate and appropriate resources and skills has also been alluded to. But what is key is to complement the ongoing initiatives and holistic approach with clearly defined roles and responsibility is the way to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mosley. You reminded me of my standard 3. Geography teacher. I'm sure you have a teaching background. The way you are explaining is very good, especially for us as people who don't have any knowledge of the scientific issues. But you make sure that we understand even the difference between yourself and the person who made her presentation of his before you. I want us, we'll take the ecosystem services and marine ecosystem. And then after that, and then we will take members for questions, clarities, and whatever. And then as for the department, we are going to take them tomorrow. But they must only deal with the overview instead of them giving us a very long report. Because when I requested Sherin to organize this workshop, I wasn't expecting her to do what she did. It's too complicated and complex for members. At least they should have basis, you know, so that they should understand what is expected from them or from us as far as oversight is concerned. We still have 5 years to go with you guys. And if it means every week you are in Cape Town, you'll have to be in Cape Town every week. But not for me to take members of parliament and expect that in one day they will understand everything in this department. I understand it's a very complex department. Even for myself, as I have said that I had a very easy committee previously, which is safety and security. Because I fought with people, they didn't fight with water and whoever, just fought with individuals. So I think here it's something else and something very much different. So it will really be a pleasure for me to invite you now and then if we need a certain sector and then you can come down to Cape Town. We can't make the difference now. We just hearing the same thing now. I don't know whether the members agree with me. We are hearing the same thing because we are all learning this, guys. But what you've come for here is so interesting. Some of these things I wasn't even aware of. And we only became aware today that we have such a huge task in front of us as this portfolio committee. If it was out of my own, I would say that let us have 2 portfolio committees. We divide ourselves, others deal with environment, others deal with water. But unfortunately, we can't. It's only one committee. But I think with you and with your support, with this coming 5 years, we'll do wonders as this portfolio committee with your assistance, of course. And then we then give to, who's next? It's Pumza. Yeah. Ms. Pumza in George. is going to give us the ecosystem services. Tomorrow we finish at 1 o'clock. When you break for lunch and then you break for good tomorrow, we're not going to sit here up to 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock. I'm sorry, Karen. We'll be very brief tomorrow. We're expecting to interact with the department, not to listen to what they're telling us. We're expecting to talk amongst each other and understand what it's all about. But unfortunately, it's not like that, but at least we are listening and then we are learning a lot from today's presentation. Ms. Pumza, it's over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try and be very brief because it's been a long day and we are all digesting, but tonight's lunch is just had. I'll give you a definition of the concepts I'll be talking about, a brief definition, and the issues surrounding those concepts, as well as what we're doing at the SSIR research in terms of addressing the issues. I'll probably remind you of your standard seven, just like your biology teacher. But biodiversity has become such a buzzword, and I sometimes think that even the people who use it forget what it means or where it comes from. It's actually biological diversity in full, and it refers to the variety and richness of plant and animal life, all the way from genetic level to ecosystem level. And it gives us warm fuzzies to go to parks and, you know, go to the coast, admire nature. We value nature for its aesthetic value mostly. But what's emerging lately is the fact that nature is also valued because it's a life support system. Human well-being really depends, everyone depends on the services that ecosystems provide. So what are these ecosystem services? They are benefits that we directly derive from ecosystems, and they are products of ecosystem processes like primary production, nutrient cycling, that sort of thing. There's a strong positive link between ecosystem processes and biodiversity. So the richer your biodiversity, the more complex and richer the ecosystem processes, and as a result, the ecosystem services derived from those biodiversity-rich ecosystems. So it just follows that a loss of biodiversity is strongly linked to a loss in ecosystem services. And currently, we are facing a crisis, if I can say it, I think globally, the three major crises we are currently facing are the global financial crisis, climate change, and the loss of biodiversity. I think it ranks as high as the other two I've just mentioned. And as I mentioned, that ecosystem services form the basic life support. A loss of biodiversity, which translates to a loss of ecosystem services or a reduction in the provision of ecosystem services, that poses a threat to human well-being, a big threat. This slide is just a summary of the previous three slides, and I'm not going to go into detail about what those different colors of the arrows mean and their width. But it's just to show that there's a link between biodiversity and the ecosystem services and the different constituents of human well-being. And of course, there are different types of ecosystems, so it follows that different types of ecosystems provide different types of ecosystem services. One of the ecosystem services that has been mentioned repeatedly today is the provision of fresh water. And the other, when we talk about ecosystems, we're not only referring to natural ecosystems, but urban ecosystems like parks and gardens also do provide ecosystem services. And cultivated ecosystems also provide ecosystem services. So that picture just to show you the different mixes and types of services that we derive from different types of ecosystems. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment that was done and finalized in 2005 shows that the status of ecosystem services has declined. In fact, all the red arrows that you see show the types of ecosystem services that have declined. And out of those provisioning services that were assessed, only three have shown an improvement, and two have remained more or less unchanged, and this is a global picture. And then when you look at regulating and cultural services, by regulating services we mean the regulation of climate, weather, they describe them in that table. The picture looks even worse because there's only one ecosystem service that has improved in the last 50 years, and the rest of them, barring three, have declined. They have become degraded. Now, what are the implications of the degradation or loss of ecosystem services? Next to climate change, it's said that ecosystem service loss or ecosystem service degradation poses a barrier to achieving Millennium Development Goals. So I think it's as important as climate change. And there's been a lot of focus today on climate change. And I would just like to highlight that ecosystem service degradation is just as important. And there are ways of addressing this, and this has been highlighted in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, but addressing this challenge will require some significant changes in policies, practices, and institutions, and I think that's where you, ladies and gentlemen, come in, because you are the decision makers. And I won't go into this into detail, but it's just to show that when we make decisions about converting ecosystems and that sort of thing, we need to consider the trade-off. Like for instance, if you take a natural ecosystem like a mangrove, it's got all those services, those ecosystem services it provides, the six listed there. But a mangrove ecosystem can be converted to housing or a shrimp farm, or it can be converted to a crop farm. But then when that is done, you lose all the other ecosystem services. These are just the things to consider when making decisions about converting one ecosystem to human-managed system. And indeed, it's been shown that the economic value of natural ecosystems is more than the economic value of converted ecosystems. The example I've just shown you of mangrove ecosystems, that oval shape I've just, it's highlighted in that oval shape I've just put on now. You can see the difference in economic value. It's expressed in dollars per hectare. I mean, if you convert a mangrove ecosystem to a shrimp farm, you lose about $750 per hectare in value. Now, to the work we do in CSIR in terms of research around biodiversity and ecosystem services, in the group that deals with this sort of stuff, we do work around the ecology of ecosystem services, what ecosystem components are important in the supply of ecosystem services, and how changes in ecosystems impact on the provision of the ecosystem services. By doing this research, we aim to contribute to ecological understanding of ecosystem services in order to promote their management and conservation. Secondly, we don't just do research for the sake of doing research. We aim to inform managers and advise them when it comes to decision-making around ecosystem management. Okay. We work with management agencies to promote informed decisions through the use of existing and emerging tools and approaches. Here I'm just giving you an example of two studies that we've done around the ecology of ecosystem services. The graph on the upper left corner is work that was done by Brian van Rogen and some colleagues of his for working for water. You can clearly see there that an intact ecosystem, that talks to the provision of fresh water, the ecosystem service that we've all heard about this morning. An intact ecosystem, that's the white bar, provides more runoff than degraded ecosystems with ecosystems that are infested with alien invasives and that sort of stuff. And then the map on the right bottom corner is some work that is being done in the Eastern Cape where we are mapping the carbon sequestration potential in that region, and that's connected to the Working for Woodlands project. The work, as I said previously, the work we do, we don't just do it for the sake of doing research. We aim to feed into decision making. Like we've provided input into the National Special Biodiversity Assessment. We're providing input into the Working for Woodlands program, as shown in the picture that's in the center there. And of course, we've done a lot of work with Working for Water. That is all. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. That was Ms. Pumza with Ecosystem Services. We'll take then the last of this presentation. That is Marine Ecosystems by Dr. Petra Montero. I understand that they don't have documents, but just ask for Mr. Kachara by the document and the presentation. Is it true that you don't have copies? How are we going to deal with this? Let me put on my glasses. I understand you promised the Secretary that you should send through the document.
Okay.
But 5 years long enough for us to go through all those documents. Okay, we'll then focus then on the screen. Over to you then.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to share some of our thinking and some of what we're doing in terms of this important area of coastal systems. Some of my colleagues that preceded me have already provided some good context for my talk, so I'll just concentrate on a few points further on. But essentially, because we're focusing on global change, the point is identifying clearly that the global change comprises the two elements of climate change, which is a sort of global, which is driven by global warming, and which is in fact the subject of Copenhagen. And then there's the issue of direct human modification of this environment, which is really around the points that we've heard until now around water use, land use, pollution, resources, etc. The two interact with each other. But linked to that is also the issue of variability, which our colleague from WRC mentioned earlier. And that's a really important point to really focus on, which is that although most of the focus on adaptation is to climate change is a fairly long-term outcome. And what's important to really realize is that we're not actually doing very well to adapt to present conditions. And even coming through, there's still too much exposure to very large floods, to coastal erosion, and a whole number of negative effects in terms of the interaction of humans and the environment. So the issue of actually understanding that if we actually do focus on understanding and being able to adapt to variability, which is the conditions that we have today, we will be in a much better position in 20, 30, 40 years' time, which is when the effects of climate change, if they're going to have the world, could be coming through in a significant way, to really have institutional spaces that are able to take up the adaptation requirements for climate change. So the issues, for example, what we have are situations where the coastal environments, which are coupled to river systems or dependent on a number of or benefit a number of different human usages, which we need to actually improve significantly in order to make the maximum benefit out of the services that they provide. Now, one area that's actually not well understood is the contrast between Southern Africa's east and west coast. And I just want to briefly mention, go through that as sort of a background, and really understand that the two parts of this part of the continent are very different coastal environments. The west coast is essentially a wind-driven coastal environment, which makes it very productive. That's where you get very cold water, and it depends on the southeasterly winds, for example, which you feel in Cape Town in summer. And those winds generate conditions where the waters are very productive and can support a very large fishery, which is why most of South African fisheries are on the west coast. But the actual biodiversity extent of the west coast is not high. It's very productive, but it's got a relatively low biodiversity. The east coast, on the other hand, is a much lower productivity, but far higher biodiversity. And it's a warm water system. Now, the importance about the east coast is that the productivity of the east coast depends on the rivers, whereas the productivity of the west coast depends on the wind. And it means that our eastern coastal system is very dependent on the way we manage our catchments. And that link, so actually seeing that the water and environment are now under the same department is really makes a major contribution towards addressing one of the important gaps that we've had in terms of understanding and making use and full benefit of the economic possibilities of the East Coast and of the West Coast. So this contrasting system. So in terms of climate change, the eastern part of our country depends on the climate change and human allocation and use of water. The west coast depends on how the winds will respond to global warming, to climate change. So these are very different environments. This has already been mentioned, the concept of ecosystem services. So the government's response to the needs of the coastal systems are really around, for example, the National Environmental Management or the Integrated Coastal Management Bill, in which we've been a strong player in terms of bringing all the players that have that could possibly contribute towards actually improving the way we understand variability and we understand change and how we might make better use of the kind of resources that the coastal systems offer. Now, in terms of really examples of the sort of effect of situations where we say, well, we're not well adapted. And this is not adapted to climate change. This is adapted to variability, of natural variability of the system. So we're building houses in places where houses should not be built. And that's really one. So this is not climate change. This is actually the way we plan the usage of our coastal zone. And similarly, we have a combination, for example, of the effect of where both rivers and storms and marine storm surges result in conditions that cause enormous damage to and impair the ability of people to live. And this again amounts to the choices that we make about the places where we live. And one of the difficulties is that Whereas that the in terms of socioeconomic issues is that the lower the means that people have, the more subject they are to actually being exposed to these risks, because they have to be, in a sense, in areas which are not necessarily where they don't have the means to absorb the risks that they are exposed to. These are further examples of the choices that we make about the way we live in a coastal zone, where in the context of natural variability, there's in fact very little scope to cope with the extreme events, which have still not much to do with climate change. They're just extreme events in the present context of climate. The kind of, this is in Cape Town, the example, these buildings on in Colt Bay are actually not insurable anymore. And yet they hold an important part of the economic benefit of the Western Cape. So another extent, another important point mentioned earlier is the importance of the length, which is an East Coast problem, of the river, the way we use our rivers, and the impact that it has on in the coastal system. We ran a 3-year program a few years ago in which we were looking at how Mozambican fisheries depended on the way South Africa used the rivers, predominantly the Nkomati and the Pongola system. And you can see without going into too much detail, that what that plot shows on the lower right-hand side is that we were able to, based on the understanding that came from the project, retrospectively predict the changing Mozambican fishery, prawn fishery, based on what the changing conditions of the river flows that were coming from South Africa into Mozambique. And and that applies all the way down the east coast of South Africa as well. Now, one of the important points around this is that approximately 25% of the tourism GDP, which is tourism accounts possibly for around about 12% of South Africa's GDP, about 25 to 30% of it is earned at the coast. So that makes coastal tourism about as important in terms of GDP as agriculture. And we have a situation where the impairment of the ability of coastal tourism to thrive is linked to a disconnection between the way coastal the coastal systems are managed and the way the river systems on which they depend are managed. In a sense, the uncoupling of those two is impairing, potentially impairing, and one just has to drive up the KwaZulu coastline to look at the estuarine system, which is where a big part of the tourism activity happens, to see just how rapidly they are degrading. And that's a responding to a problem, a now problem, rather than a climate change problem. So the urgency of, in a sense, the better we are at addressing the issues that we are facing now, and especially the exposure the rapid urbanization is putting. And the exposure that people that are part of the rapid urbanization are exposed to, is the better we're going to be to cope with the requirements of longer-term climate change. This is an example of a data set which gives another side of things. I got this from our colleagues at Marine and Coastal Management. And it shows how the important fisheries of the West Coast shift from the West Coast to the south coast over a multi-year cycle. So the blue-yellow periods are when the fisheries on the west coast. The redder areas are when the fisheries move to the east coast. And I'm sure we heard a lot about this in the past few years, when in fact a lot of the fishery was being caught near PE as opposed to off St. Helena Bay. And this is an example of where it's variability. But because it lasts more than a few years, it requires an adaptive response by our institution. And so this is about the issue of the balance between adapting to variability and adapting to long-term change. So adapting to existing variability is again the key point here. One of the significant contributions that our colleagues at Marine Coastal Management are making is a shift towards managing not individual stocks, but actually managing entire systems. It's called an ecosystem approach to fisheries. And these pictures show why it's important, why that's important. The picture on the right are actually albatross that were caught from one long-line fishing boat on one fishing expedition as a result of the tuna fishing activity. So the collateral damage that much of us, the fishing activity causes on the rest of the system has an impact on the stability of these systems. So in a sense, the need to actually develop an ecosystem approach and minimize this kind of, in a sense, additional cost that that comes with the benefit or the fish that we get out of the fishing industry. Another important area is not so much the coastal systems, but the oceans around it. Most of our rainfall, almost all our rainfall, comes from the three oceans around southern Africa. And those arrows point to the dominant direction from where the rainfall comes. So the summer rainfall that we have comes from the equatorial and Atlantic and Indian Oceans, which are on the left and the right of southern Africa. And the winter rainfall, which we're experiencing in Cape Town right now, comes from the southern ocean, which is the bottom arrow. The changes that are going to be happening in those oceans over the next few decades are the ones that are actually going to shape the changes in our rainfall. And that's an important area of work that we as an institution, together with our colleagues in other institutions in southern Africa, are putting our minds to try to improve and lower, to improve the predictability of the kind of changes that might be coming. Now, apart from the rainfall issue, there's also what the discussions in Copenhagen, which are about carbon dioxide emissions. Now, one of the main assumptions in emission negotiations, such as in Copenhagen, is that the natural flux of CO2, the flux of the exchange of CO2 between the ocean and the atmosphere, that is not going to change. Okay, that's an important assumption in the targets that are being set at the moment. That is highly unlikely. And the difficulty is that the natural CO2 exchange between the ocean and the atmosphere is, the important thing is it's balanced. So the same, it's very large, but it's balanced in the sense that as much goes out, it comes back into the ocean. But it's so large that a small change in that flux can equally offset the kind of mitigation target that we are going for in Copenhagen. So that, in a sense, puts a real urgency, another element of urgency in terms of getting the actual human emissions and limiting the extent of climate change. And the southern ocean, south of Africa, is one of the important areas of the world where the ocean naturally takes up CO2. So one of the areas that we are working extensively on now, together with our international colleagues, is actually understanding a little better how that might be changing. Okay, so that's the one of the important issues. Part of this is related to an important initiative of the Department of Science and Technology, which is the Global Change Grand Challenge. And this is coordinating Southern African work. I'm putting this here for the committee to be for part of the discussion that, in fact, there's a lot of other activity which is going on, which has a bearing on the discussions that you made that may be of interest to you. And so this is very, very new. It's still actually coming to final stages of formulation. But in a sense, there's a coordinated plan around which South African science of global change is being organized. There's also, in terms of information support, is the new Climate Research Center, which will be launched in the very near future, which is ACCESS, which is the Africa Center for Climate and Earth System Science. And that's going to be an important resource to provide not only the research, to coordinate the research in Southern Africa, but also to provide all the elements of our society with the information and products that will help us cope with both climate variability and climate change. So it comprises a research element, an operational element, which is really about predicting the change, and there's also a very strong educational component to it. Right. I will leave it there, and in the sense that those are the sort of key elements of that I would just bring to the table. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I see we are on our way to Stellenbosch Campus. Yeah, definitely. Just around the corner. We'll go there. Those who are near here in Parliament, at least start with them before we go to Parliament. Stellenbosch, you can even do that during the quality time. Instead of us sitting around here for 3 hours, you can go quickly to Stellenbosch Campus. Thank you very much. That was Dr. Petros. Keep my paper away. That was Dr. Petros from, that is, he did the marine ecosystem. I'm sure that by now that members are tired of listening. Now I'll give the opportunity to members now to ask for clarity, questions, and comments, since from the very first presenter, media cluster, the minister. So I will open then for members. The time is now 4:15. I'll give to members to ask those questions until such time. I'll be guided by members then. All questions directed to whoever, you know your presentation. You'll hear when the question is coming your way. Then you'll prepare yourself for responding. And in other regards, the department can also assist in responding to some of the questions. Because I promised last week that even from the presentation that was made by individual boards, the department promised me that they will be able to respond to some of the questions if members so feel to ask something that was said last week. I have recognized Honorable Kosana, Honorable Morgan, Honorable Mamu Zigalala, and Honorable Luyen.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've been listening since early this morning. If I suppose to write a test, I should have, in fact, obtaining 100% with this geography and biology that I was listening to. Chairperson, after I've listened to all presenters here, I found that at the present moment, as members of parliament, we've got a difference between water line and environmental line. Everything is clear to us now. But what is left is to translate this biology and geography into reality, in the sense that how do we create projects for the people? Because if I'm listening here, one of the fundamental issues that I'm here for is to know how do we create projects for the people? How does the community benefit to all what we were saying? To us, it's not a problem. Geography is biology, I was listening. I've been a teacher for 22 years. I was listening very attentively and I got the content of what you are saying here. Can we just be clarified, especially the environmental affairs? Which projects are, in fact, are beneficial to the communities in that line? I only know two, but I don't know the others. That is recycling and greening. And what next? Can we just be pros on board? And also, in the issue of fishermen, I know when we are talking about the fishermen, only whites who have got the skill and who are able to fisher. Now, I just want to get a plan from our department in terms of developing those people who are deprived rights to fishery. In fact, those who are living in rural areas, the black and colored people in particular, is there any plan to assist them to give them that skill so that they can be able to fish? And lastly, Chairperson, is the issue of exposure to this legislation that we are going to use when we protect these resources. We are talking about our resources here. The resources of the country. I must be able to say, this water, I supposed to protect this water under this legislation. I supposed to protect trees, and I supposed to work up to this far. I should think those are the legislations. The exposure of the legislations. Can we be just clarified whether we'll be given those legislations that are in place, and which one should be increased maybe in future? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
Honourable Morgan.
Thank you, Chair. There was a huge amount of information. And a lot of it's general. I'll something that's been on my mind for a while with regards to the water sector, so I'm not sure who would answer it, possibly Water Research Commission or CSIR. And that is the issue of where are we at the moment with the determining of the ecological reserves for our rivers? I know it has been done in a few cases, but I'm also aware with sort of the allocation of water rights, and often also when you consider the issue of granting licenses, which really have to be based on information that says, well, X amount of water needs to be retained in the system in order to sustain the integrity of that system before we actually then can allocate the rest to mining, agriculture, industry, and human consumption. Now, when you think of the fact that in recent times the Olifant River has stopped flowing twice, there is a problem there that I would suggest that the ecological reserve of that river is not being managed properly. It's not just a case of water stopping. I mean, the ecological reserve, if you know it, would suggest that if it looks like that's going to happen, then someone has to have reduced water extraction rights. So where are we at the moment? And then linked to that, I mean, are our methodologies with regard to measuring these reserves, are they sophisticated enough, or are they still a work in progress? And then lastly, are we confident enough that the ecological reserves can be defended in a court of law? Because when you have water licenses, which is a contested field, so of course some people gain and some people lose, some people don't get what they want, then, of course, one of the things that can be attacked is whether or not the ecological reserve is set too high, in the sense that is there not, you know, some people might say, is there not more water, should there not be more water available for extraction? So I'd appreciate some comments from the relevant scientists or officials on that particular issue. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
Honourable
Beginner.
Chairperson, it was good listening to the presenters today, but I'm afraid we nearly, you know, to cover a syllabus of 5 years in one day. That is almost what happened today. And I agree with you that we are going to invite them, let's say, 1, 2, 3, to come to portfolio committee, because there are very important issues here. For instance, if you take climate change, global change, warming, I can name them. They are very important. And it is not just easy for one day to
class?
Well, I'm going back to my things. It has been mentioned that rural areas, people from the rural areas, they suffer from scarcity of clean, I underline, clean water. Essences of every citizen in our country has to drink clean water has been made. What do we do? What do we mean by clean water? Going to the rural areas, I always do visit, see, listen. You find that people are drinking water from the rivers, water that has been polluted by animals, urine, and other things. Water that has been polluted by washings. They wash on the north of the river. On the south, they are drinking. So, Jefferson, what are we doing about that? What best can be done to help the people from the rural areas have clean water? At a certain stage, something has been suggested. What about water tanks? Well, I don't know. Maybe from the presenter, somebody can try and help to clarify what happens in order for them to obtain those water tanks. At times, you know, there are questions which become a sing-song from a member. And a member will continue asking them until she or he has an answer. I remember when you referred me to this workshop at a certain stage when I was asking some of these questions. I still want to know, and I'm very, very worried, Jefferson, about this. But the day I get the answer, I'll be happy. There are dams which are situated at certain areas, but they are not servicing the communities. For instance, I can make mention of the Jozini Dam in Northern Natal, that is KZN. Nyaga Dam, Bushbuck Ridge, I have no idea, but the complaint is there, that those dams are just white elephants because they don't service the people there. Maybe today one can get just an answer so that you can explain to the people you are representing in Parliament here. And it has been mentioned that there are projects that are, you know, and I'm very much interested to know what are those projects? Empowering rural women, how? Because communities, I'm just speaking just like an ordinary lay person, because I'm representing people here. I need to get some of these things clear so that I can go back and tell them something for nothing, if possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kigera. I'm sure the DG from Water Affairs is here. She'll have to respond on some of the questions that are directed to her department. Honorable Nguyen.
Yeah, thanks, Jefferson. Without repeating what the other members have actually said, allow me, Chair, to appreciate
the information about this department. I never thought this department is so sophisticated. You know, it's just like on my first day when I was doing honors, then I said, hey, am I going to come back when it is this hard? But one thing that I actually identified here is the level of capacity within the officials that they have. They seem to know exactly what this department is about, and each and every one of them understands the responsibility that one has. I want us to ask the officials, because we rely on them. Because as public representatives, it's not a matter of us understanding what this department is all about. What you want to see happening, Tina, is the benefit of all this to the previously marginalized communities that we are representing. You know, the question that was posed by Honorable Kosana here regarding the projects that would benefit the poor. I mean, it's an issue that the department needs to assist us, because the role of this department, it was not very clear. I don't know whether who told you that, no, it's important to have a session of this nature, because this session has actually equipped us as members. Now we understand. Then let's move forward. Assist us as a department. Let us ensure that there is something out of all what you are doing which benefits the poor. I mean, at your own right, you can be involved, you might be involved in politics. You know exactly what is it that you actually want. But in some stages, you also understand that, no, they may not understand this one. This is very sophisticated. It must not be a matter of us asking you as to what should have happened. You must just tell us, I should have done this. It should have been done in this fashion to benefit the people. But it does not. It could not if 1, 2, 3, 4 has not happened. So that the chairperson is in a good position to tell Parliament that in that department, this is what is supposed to be done for that department to be able to assist the poor of the poorest that we are representing. I mean, it's so sophisticated, and it is so encouraging to have our own people understanding their own jobs and functions clearly in this fashion. I don't know, because our districts will have to sit on their toes, because all this knowledge that I got from here, I will oversight my district office at the level, at a constituency level. So, even the role here of the department, ODG will assist us, the role of the department to ensure that in municipalities they also follow suit. I just perused this document, this strategic plan. This is what you are best using as parliamentarians. You can give us a pack of books, and then you expect members not to be able to engage you. Members will engage you. They are specializing on that one. They will ask questions because they know what they want. What are you talking about, my area? What about, is there any involvement of the communities in this thing? Then it will come out that, but in your strategic objectives, it is there. All these questions, the person that we are asking to the board is here. And this is not a strategic plan of the board. This is a strategic plan of the department. But the department was not telling us as to where do they feature in terms of assisting them. This monitoring that they have over department and oversight that they have over the board, it is very clear here, but when the right time comes, in the next 5-6 months, we'll be able to ask them, in as far as the strategic plans are concerned, say, were you able to do 1, 2, 3, 4, and what? Otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, members, for those questions and
encouraging words to the department. Before I give to department, oh, Mamu Tugelen?
Chairperson, I would like to thank the CSIR very much for providing us with these DVDs. Thank you so much. I believe and I hope we're going to learn more when we play them. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Member. Yeah, I will give to whoever is going to respond on some of these questions and also to the DG of Water Affairs to respond to the question by Uma Muzigala, because that question has been asked since last time and the board didn't have time to respond to some of those questions that were directed to themselves. Yes, Honorable Wieng, I agree with you that it seems that the presenters or the department, they know what is expected from them. But the big question is, they must translate that knowledge to action. Because if they know what is expected from them, we're not expecting them to get a qualified report for 6 years. They must do what they are talking about. They must, do they have the capacity of translating that into action? And then if they show us that they have the capacity of translating that into action, then we'll sit here and say that they've got a good strategic plan. Strategic plan versus the annual report. They must go together. If you say that you want so much for them and you are giving so much for them, but when the report comes, it's not done the way it's supposed to have done. Because if it was correct, Auditor General wouldn't have a qualified opinion on most of these issues. So the reason that we decided to have such a gathering with the department is precisely what you are hearing today. Because as I have said that this is a new portfolio with a new department, we wanted to find out whether they know what is expected from them. Because we as a portfolio, we know what are our responsibilities. When it comes to oversight, we know what is it that is expected from ourselves as the portfolio committee. It doesn't matter what kind of a portfolio committee is, the portfolio committee is a portfolio committee. Even if I come from another sector, what oversight means is the same as oversight. The issue of the board, it's a worrying factor. The relationship between the Department of Water Affairs and the board is a worrying factor. Other boards are doing very well. They even have relationships with certain countries, but they don't have relationships among themselves. As a result, we have boards that are not functioning. Make an example about Namakwa. Is it Namakwa? Yeah, is it Namakwa? Yeah, Namakwa and some other boards. So if we, the department will be in a position of assisting this board, and some of the boards were saying that to the portfolio committee, they don't get equal support from the department. There are those who are favored above the others. So such things, we don't want to hear such things as the portfolio committee. If you support the board, support them all. If you don't support, don't support. But it's sad to discover that there are those boards that are suffering and those that are not suffering. So that we expect the boards to assist, the department to assist the boards so that if it needs be, then we can come up with a legislation that will bind the department to assist the boards if needs be. But what I was saying is that the strategic plan is very good. The presentation is very good. The intentions are very good. The problem is, how do we translate that into action so that we should all understand what is it that is needed of, what is our responsibilities. I will then give to those who respond to questions, and after which then I will take some more questions if there are some of the questions. Otherwise, we'll have to be
to finish here at 5 o'clock so that we start tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I mean at 9 o'clock. We start at 9 so that by 1 o'clock we finish tomorrow. Gigi, what happens?
Thank you, Jefferson. I will comment on some of the issues because I assume that tomorrow we're doing a full presentation on what we're doing as a department. So I'll be guided by you, Chair. Do we respond to the questions now, or do we
you respond to those directly questions that are directed to you? Your presentation will do tomorrow. Like the ones about the dams that Mama asked about the dams.
Okay. I think, let me just then go through those. There was a question about the dam. There was a question about the board. And my colleagues can talk about the reserve determination. And then I think the Honorable Zikalala also spoke about access generally in many parts of the country. Thank you, Chair. The issue of single purpose dams. It's an issue that South Africa has been faced with for a long time. That dams in the past were developed in some cases to serve certain industries like mining, in some cases agriculture. It's a problem that we've identified as a department, and we're starting with a few projects to deal with. One of them is Daung Dam in the Northwest Province, where we've done Daung Dam in the Northwest was used for irrigation. In the past just for irrigation. And we've done pre-feasibility work that shows that we need an amount of 165 million to convert that into a dam that will service people around the area. And it's part of the projects that we're looking at as part of the bulk infrastructure program in moving forward. There's also Pongola Jozini Dam, which is the northern KwaZulu-Natal. Again, the work there was done by the, in fact, the project is led by the provincial government, and we were part of that process. And again, this one also, to get it, to convert it to serve the communities around the dam, we will need an amount of 800 million. And we're still working with the province in terms of identifying the funding sources to convert that particular dam. In the meantime, we've been working with them in terms of looking at drilling boreholes, and this project was launched around about April, the boreholes project, to try and deal with the problem in the short term. And then with regard to Nyaka Dam, which is in Mpumalanga, specifically there's work ongoing there. It's going to cost an amount of 283 million and about 900,000 people will benefit. And Chairperson, there's a whole lot of other dams that we still find ourselves as a legacy of the past. So we started with these ones, and as we're moving forward, we're going to be looking at the rest. But in terms of policy direction moving forward, we now have a policy of having multi-purpose dams, that you don't have a dam just constructed for a single purpose. So that's the response with regard to dams. The other dams that we're constructing, will give a whole outline when we do a presentation tomorrow in terms of what's in the pipeline and where it occurs. On the issue of boards, Jefferson, I think there could be a lot of improvement on our side as a department in terms of our oversight. The responsibility with regard to those goals. But I think at the same time, I think it also sometimes it's a two-way process. That the work that we've done in terms of what we call the Institutional Realignment Project, which was basically a process to look at exactly where how we're going to have, how many boards we're going to have, or water boards we're going to, whether the ones that were established in the past were in fact in themselves viable. We made a presentation earlier this morning, and we did a board by board account in terms of which ones can sustain themselves, and which ones that in all reality, like Namakwa, it's not viable to continue with that board. And we've had, in the last couple of months, we've had meetings with that particular board specifically. And the reality is that there's just no way that they're going to be able to be sustainable with a decline in mining in that particular district. So as part of the way forward, we need then decisions to be made at the right level in terms of which how many water boards are we going to have in this country? Are we going to go for the 14 that we have, or are we going to reduce them somewhat, especially those that are struggling? There is a proposal in terms of the work around the institutional realignment to go for 9 once the problem. But that's a proposal. That's what it is. It has not been adopted by this new minister. The work was commissioned by the previous minister, and still work that we still need to get decisions and apply our minds to. But in the meantime, as I said, the issue of relationships between ourselves and the board can always can be improved, and we'll be the first ones to admit that. But also, I think vice versa, we can look at an improvement in the relationship also from the board side. Because sometimes these things are not necessarily about process and what needs to be done. Sometimes they do hinge around the individuals, and it's something that any organization, institution needs to do with. But be that as it may, I think we can improve on the issue of the relationship. Thirdly, on the issue of access, I think this issue was dealt with early in the morning as well, and it's an ongoing issue in terms of our responsibility as a department of water affairs. The fact that we're not necessarily a water service authority does impact on our ability to play a role in terms of access. Because primarily that's a municipal responsibility. We play a role in terms of support to municipalities. We do play a role in terms of regulation and make sure that the services, and we do also play a role in terms of support at the policy level, and also certain forums where we the whole issue of funding and access is looked into. But I mean, I think that on its own does have its own limitations. If you're not the authority to make decisions around access, but we have in the last year identified resources from our own budget to assist municipalities, and that program looks at helping with access, addressing access, looks at the issue of wastewater treatment plants in assisting municipalities in that regard. We will obviously give more detail tomorrow in terms of which projects are we looking at and where they're situated with regard to access that we're supporting as a department, but primarily the municipal infrastructure grant and the equitable share to municipalities. It's meant to be the funding source to assist municipalities in terms of achieving access.
Thank you very much, Tichi. If I heard you clearly, you are saying to us you don't see any need to continue with Namakwa Water Board. That's what you are saying.
What I'm saying is that the reports that we've done and the investigation that we've done shows that that particular water board is not viable, financially viable.
Does it exist? The question, does it exist? It's also the name. Because we were here last week. It's a board that is run by one person. Are you doing oversight over this board?
Chairperson, we are. This water board, I personally have visited, and my colleagues in the last year have also visited the water board. So I went once, and my colleagues went twice. Maybe you could give more information. But there's a number of issues around that board. There is one person, but it's also that person is supported by an organization, a company that is contracted by that particular board to undertake work on its behalf. But the reality is that it's not able to generate enough revenue to even pay for basic bills that it has. For example, when I was there about 4 months ago, one of the things that they couldn't pay was the Eskom account. The amount that they were generating a month was far less to even pay that one account, let alone other operations. So one of the issues for me, it's very clear that it's a big issue about sustainability of that institution. But I think there is a process in terms of disestablishing a water board. But that's not necessarily a decision that lies with officials. But as I'm saying, that we have done an institutional oversight project that we still have to get the new administration to look at and see if it adopts it. But I don't know if we can...
Madam Chair, the issue of Namakwa is very complicated. Namakwa Water Board still exists. The problems there are both technical as well as to some degree institutional. The technical problem basically is that the Water Board has to cut water some 200 kilometers from the source to the consumer. And that water has to be pumped over the mountain from the Orange River, almost Orange River mouth, to Springbok and some other towns in the vicinity. To get water to those consumers is very expensive. You're talking about pipes that burst as a result of pressure buildup and all that sort of thing. That water is very expensive for the consumer. And again, given the volumes that are required, the Water Board finds it very difficult to actually generate enough revenue to meet its operational costs. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but the department has been to Springbok, to Namakwa, under the leadership of the Director General, and the municipality is aware of the challenges. But again, the municipality has a problem because if they take over the operation, it suggests that the municipality has to actually put in the bid. So you have a situation here where it is just too expensive for the Water Board to survive because the municipality is not paying, they cannot pay. But at the same time, the municipality would like the situation to remain as is because at least for as long as there is a partner in terms of meeting the operational cost, that's what suits the municipality rather than them taking over everything. And as the DG has indicated, to disestablish Namakwa, you have to have a municipality saying, I will take over the water service. And that's what they are not prepared to do at this stage. So that is the latest, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. Gigi, I will ask you for a favor now for the benefit of Umamuzi Galala for her constituency. Can you find out for us what is happening in Jozini? Jozini, then, that's where her interests are as a person who is deployed in that constituency. You must know that when we serve these constituencies, when they have challenges as far as water, anything is concerned, the first person that they would approach is a member of parliament. So you feel very disillusioned as a member of parliament if you can't give those people a response, a very positive one. Response. At least she must know how to respond to the community. If only you can find out and then communicate directly with Mamu Sikarala for the constituency. Thank you very much for your response there. Now, then we'll see when time goes, which what is happening with Namakwa. But I think the person who came, the acting CEO, something like that, he was very open with the portfolio committee. He said exactly what you are saying. He was very open, and he did tell us about the challenges that they faced with. I don't know whether there are some, did you have environment?
Thank you, Chair. Just on the questions that were raised, I think by Honorable Member Kosana, on the project and fisheries, Let me start on the fisheries, honorable members. We had the allocations of medium-term fishing rights in 2001, which were followed by the long-term rights that were then issued in 2005. And those allocations in 2005 were also benchmarked on the basis of transformation targets that were considered. I'm getting to then the answer in relation to the previously disadvantaged individuals and their participation in the fishing sector. What then happens is that after 2 years or two years, we start the review process. So we're currently on a performance review process to check or assess compliance to the various targets or the various measures, performance measures that were put in place for those long-term rights allocations, including transformation compliance measures. And what then would happen once that report is concluded, then the executive would then have to consider interventions that are within the law or legally defensible, because it is not possible to just withdraw or change the terms of the rights that were allocated without a proper process. That process will therefore ensue on the basis of that review. And then in respect of training, training was therefore not necessarily provided with the rights that have been allocated. The department did not provide training, except that it's part of the what one would call a scorecard for those right holders to develop capacity and also to ensure that there is continued equity in respect of the running of the business. We then have relied on the actual fishing companies to actually provide that capacity development with their partners, which are part of the company in most instances. However, in a year, I think last year, the previous Committee on Environment raised an issue with us on investigating support interventions for fishing, for SMEs in the fishing sector, including investigating viability of cooperatives as a model. And as a department, we then only started with that process in this financial year because we did not have funding for it, to actually explore what models exist elsewhere in the world around support that could be provided to the emerging sector that's involved within the fishing industry. And again, we are also bound by international protocols on how we will do that, because in terms of the WTO arrangements, we say in South Africa we don't subsidize our sector, and would have to find a balance in terms of how we would deal with that, which is why we have to undergo an investigation. And I would think, honorable members, when we have that those models, we would then brief you at a later stage in the course of the year. And then lastly, I think on skills development, we do have programs that are more geared to staff that's involved with the marine science field in the department. And in that regard, we have actually made real progress in respect of the knowledge base of the institution. But we have not yet, overcome the shortage of skill in that sector. Then the next question on the project. There are a number of environmental projects that we are involved in through the Expanded Public Works Program, because part of the function of the portfolio is very much about regulatory function, enforcement to environmental compliance, and so on. and basically people that get employed there, or that the job opportunities are more on maybe environmental management inspectors, but there's a limit to which we are able to absorb them because we are very much dependent on the budget. But then on the expanded public works program, we do have short-term employment linked to skills development and empowerment of beneficiaries through the wetland rehabilitation program, which is an environmental program, also in water affairs, a sister program on working for water program, which is looking at rehabilitating landscapes and including controlling invading alien species, particularly plants, not the marine species at the current moment, and other land conservation programs or land rehabilitation programs, including natural resource-based programs. And basically there, as I indicated, we have numbers and statistics that show that we have beneficiaries in all provinces and various districts that we have projects that we are engaged on. And there is opportunities to do more, but again, this also hinges on waste management, particularly hinges on what municipalities have in terms of budget that could then encourage them to provide services, environmental services like waste collection services and even air quality monitoring functions. So those are areas where we're still working with DPLG to ensure that that function is funded at a local government level. Thanks, Honourable Member.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure whether there are still some outstanding questions, because I think we'll have an opportunity tomorrow, because tomorrow we'll be dealing directly with the two departments. Nobody wants to. Honourable Morgan, come again.
Is it possible to get an answer on my question?
Honourable Morgan's question. Who noted that? Is that you, please? Okay.
The question around water rights, ecological reserve, water licenses, and some river systems going dry, I think that is the question that I noted. I want to bunch this with the question from Honorable Kosan, where he's asking about legislation, the benefits and the challenge, because that bit of question links to what the Honorable Member asked. When the system is going dry because of some reason, it could be anything, it could be drought that has been creeping in unnoticed, it could be climate change as we listened today, all the changes that come with that, or excessive abstraction of water from the system, including illegal water use. So there, what we do on the ground can lead to the system going dry. You may find that the license was issued and the ecological reserve was determined, but because of all these things, you could end up with the system going dry. Then let us link it to the challenges resulting from the legislation. The National Water Act, we always say, a progressive act, and it is true. But at the same time, it is so complicated and so comprehensive for a nation that is developing. You have sections in that act which sometimes make it difficult to do certain things. The Bito municipality case is the case at hand, where a municipality has applied for a water license, and the minister has given that water license. Bito municipality wants to get water from some river and use that water to supply the communities in the area. But at the same time, you have members within that area who are challenged with that issuing of license. And the case is before the tribunal. Here, the water that we are talking about is the water that is called a reserve water for the people. It hasn't come first. But because of the act that is so advanced, you could have one person challenge the decision by the minister. And that is how far you can go when you have an advanced act, but at the same time allowing everyone to have a say at any given time. And here, the issue is, I'm told the CSIR did some research there, and they have confirmed that by taking water from that river to the people, given the quantity, that system will not go dry. But because that very act allows people to challenge certain decisions, that municipality is at crossroads. So you have all these things coming into play. There's nothing wrong with the act, but because everyone is allowed to have a say, you have those situations. Even here with the water rights, with the ecological reserve and all that, let alone that things change because it is a natural system, but you also have those factors coming into play, making life somewhat difficult for some of the officials and would-be water users in those areas. I thought, let me bunch this together because it can create some picture as well for particularly people that are interested in the river systems vis-a-vis all the things that we do and the decisions that are taken at that level. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is that understandable, Honorable Morgan? That's fine then. I think as for today, we've come to the end of this long day. We'll meet tomorrow morning. We'll take both departments and then give to members of parliament to ask questions, clarifications, or to deliberate to the report of the department. But we'll make sure that by 1 o'clock we can all go wherever you come from.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I have one last response that I wanted to make to a question from Honourable Member Morgan, who had said that the presentations from the scientists were very general and very brief. And I just wanted to say in closing, I think all of us from the scientific community are frustrated by having to present in such a brief and such a general way incredibly, what we think is incredibly interesting and incredibly dynamic work, and nothing that we've presented today really captures not just what's going on in the science community, but how that's being translated into action and policy, and it is being translated into action and policy. So hopefully this isn't just a once-off and it's the start of a dialogue with the Portfolio Committee, and we'll have a chance to come back and speak in detail about some of what's going on.
Thank you very much. You'll definitely come back again. I'm sure of that, because when members go through your documents, they will come across some interesting stuff then, and then they'll need more clarity from yourselves. Members, thank you very much. Thanks, Karen. Thanks. Sit next to me. We'll meet again tomorrow morning with those who are coming back tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.